This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, America, or whatever your time zone across this beautiful planet Earth of ours. You're tuned in to the People Speak radio show with Steve Johnson. The People Speak show normally airs every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific and 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS radio network. Anyone can participate during the show with call-in questions for our guests toll-free in the USA and Canada on 1-888-429-5471. That number again, 1-888-429-5471. Or you can join us live in the government and politics section of Pal Talk, the largest free chat program in the world, where we have a virtual radio room called the People Speak Radio Show, where anyone may join to participate during the show. We have a truly amazing researcher and book author on the show today. I'm more excited than John McCain at a KKK meeting. She's a brave and courageous woman who has traveled to Gaza and the West Bank in the year 2000 to see for herself the despicable barbarity of the Zionist state firsthand. She is the executive director of If Americans Knew and the president of the Council for the for National Interest. Her official website detailing the war crimes of Israel is www.ifamericansknew.org. Her new book is called Against Our Better Judgment, The Hidden History of How the U.S. Was Used to Create Israel, which exposes the endemic infiltration of Zionist power in the United States right here today, right through the 20th century until today. Welcome to the People Speak radio show, Miss Allison Weir, ma'am.
Hi, thank you for having me on your show.
It sure is a pleasure to finally be speaking with you, that's for sure. A lot of your work actually inspired my own work in my YouTube channel called Stop Funding Israel. I've been using If Americans Knew as a resource for years. The facts on there cannot be debated. Thank you for doing that.
Thank you. I'm so glad to hear that you're using that. It's, you know, you sort of put this information out there and you hope people will find it and make use of it. So I'm glad to hear that worked.
I'm sure that your website has actually changed lives and has actually changed people's minds, because the stuff cannot be debated. We'll be taking audience questions after the first half hour, but my first question to you, Ms. Weir, ma'am, is what prompted you to visit Palestine in 2000 at a time when Americans generally would have avoided that region completely?
that's true. I was... What happened with me is I had never focused on this issue before. I'm not Jewish or Arab or Muslim, and I had never really studied Israel-Palestine. I'd been active in some other issues, anti-Vietnam War, for example, and civil rights. But I hadn't known much about that one until fall of 2000 was the beginning of the Second Intifada, as it's called, the Palestinian Uprising. It was in the news a bit, and I decided just sort of randomly to pay attention to it and learn what it was about. And when I did that, my background is journalism. I was at that time the editor of a very small newspaper in Northern California. So as a journalist, I noticed that it was really very one-sided coverage. And I wanted the full picture, so I went to the internet to start to see what I could learn there. Discovered excellent news sources from the region itself, found out about the massive violence Israeli forces were committing against Palestinians. And after a few months, I was so shocked at what I felt was really the widest and longest cover-up I'd ever seen that I quit my job in California and traveled over to the West Bank and Gaza as a freelance reporter to see for myself what was going on. So that was sort of the beginning of all of this.
How were you received by the Palestinians there in the West Bank and Gaza? How did they receive you, being an American in a foreign land?
They were very welcoming. You know, it's amazing, and I've been back there since. And every time there people, you know, basically what people say to you when they hear that you're an American is welcome. I would always tell people I was an American journalist, and they were excited to see that an American journalist was there to see what was going on. people were very friendly. They treated me with respect. I was completely safe. In a number of cases, people invited me to stay in their homes, which is what I gladly did. So it's very different than the way we're led to believe we'll be treated. There was certainly unhappiness, to say the least, about U.S. governmental actions. People were very aware that it was American tax money and weaponry that was enabling Israeli actions. But they did not translate the hostility towards our government to individual Americans, which was interesting to see. So, you know, when I've traveled around there, people smile. They are happy to see that an American's there to learn what's going on. And, you know, I did see what was going on, and that's what I came back to start If Americans Knew for to try to tell others those facts.
So you're saying that the local Palestinian population, they were able to differentiate the actions of the American government as opposed to the ordinary, everyday American people.
Exactly. That's exactly what I found on that trip and on other trips.
Wow. You did mention in your book called Against Our Better Judgment, and I recommend this book to anyone who wants to get a clearer view on what's really happening behind the scenes and how this has come to where we are today in 2015. You do mention in your book that the Israeli lobby in the United States has acted illegally over the years in order to influence U.S. foreign policy, in order to influence senators and congressmen, and to influence laws. How much of a threat do you believe they are to America? How much of a threat is the Israeli lobby to America, in your opinion?
I think it's an enormous threat. I think it's causing great damage to our own country. You know, in addition to the massive damage and tragedy it's creating in the Middle East, throughout the Middle East, to Palestinians and others, but it's causing great harm to the United States. It's undermining principles that most of us believe in. It's causing great sums of money to be sent to a foreign nation to be used improperly, which is taking money away from our own economy. It's causing hostility to Americans because our politicians are supporting activities that most Americans would absolutely abhor, would find despicable activities. We would not support them. But our government is doing that because largely because of the Israel lobby, because of its power in Washington, D.C., in influencing congressional legislation, in very, very active in the executive branch, pervasive in the mainstream American media. So this is the part that in some ways is the most covered up. What's happening in the region is certainly very poorly reported. Most people have little idea how bad it is, because most of the reporting is always Israeli-centric. It's always focused on Israel and on Israelis, and Palestinians are sort of relegated to, you know, just collateral damage when they're being killed in large numbers and killed first. Mm. So bad as that cover-up is, bad as that news coverage is, the situation within the United States is even more covered up, and in some ways even more significant. So my book tells some of how that began. That it began a long time ago and was very pervasive for many decades, long before most of us were aware that there even was such a lobby.
One thing that really blew me away was the sheer amount of money that these animals could call up, even in some of the years gone by, that they amassed amazing fortunes to do their dirty work. Do you think that's one of the reasons why they became so powerful, because they had a lot of financial backers?
Certainly money gives you power. You know, money is power. You have the money to, you know, to pay people salaries, to funnel campaign donations to people that you want to have elected in order to defeat people of principle that you don't want to return to Congress or to the presidency. You have money for television, newspaper, advertising, programs. Money is power. Most of us know that. And this is a group that managed to acquire a great deal of money and used it very effectively. One thing I just like to maybe take issue a little bit, I still don't like the idea of calling people animals. Even
I'm sorry, ma'am. I take that back. Yeah.
That's okay. I mean, certainly the actions are at times are ferocious and despicable. But, you know, we're all human, and I guess probably you, like I, keep hoping that we'll reach the humanity in everyone and try to bring that out and not continue the kind of vicious hatred that we see occurring so often with the Israeli government against Palestinians.
Yes, ma'am. I do contend with that. I do agree with that, that most people do deserve a chance to show their humanity. But after reading your book, I was furious. I mean, I thought I knew a lot about the Israeli-Palestine situation, but I realized I don't know much at all compared to what you've got in your book. It is an encyclopedia of the history of the Israeli lobby, and it's so well-referenced. Half of your book is indeed the references to everywhere you get your information. I've never read such a well-researched book, and I commend you on that. That's fantastic. Have you had much response from people reading the book like that?
Yeah, there's been a wonderful response. It's been really exciting because both people that are completely new to the issue are finding it accessible and interesting, which was my goal, was to make it for, you know, somebody the way I was 15 years ago, to be able to pick up this book, read through it, and understand it. Wouldn't be Palestine 400 in those terms. However, it does, right within the main text, and then additionally in the endnotes and the footnotes, there's additional information that for people like you and others that have been aware of this issue for quite a while, including many experts that have been studying it for decades and many Palestinian Americans who have grown up very aware of it, everybody has been extremely surprised to find information in my book that they had not known before. You know, I did my research from scratch. I did it at a time when I had access to obscure books that normally you would only be able to get if you went to the Library of Congress, which isn't very convenient for most people. So mm-hmm. It's exciting to see that both people that know the issue quite well are amazed at some of the information available in my book. And the reviews, the customer reviews on Amazon are overwhelmingly positive. Almost all are giving it 5 stars. It's around 350 customer reviews, which is a very large number for any book, especially, you know, this is not a book published by a mainstream publisher. It hasn't been pushed by mainstream newspaper. You know, NPR has never discussed it. Terry Gross has not had me on her show. Amy Goodman has not had me on her show. You know, despite that, the book is doing extremely well. And the customer reviews are saying things like, eye-opening, every American should read this book, it should be required reading in high school. So it's sort of this grassroots kind of movement that I think ultimately will be what will bring the change up in this issue in general. And that's what I'm experiencing with the book.
Just to clarify for the listening audience, is it true, which I read in your book, that some Zionists early in Israel's creation saw the indigenous Palestinians as a real pressing moral problem to their plans to create the State of Israel? That there were some Zionists who were against that plan because of the Palestinians living there?
That's correct. You know, the Zionist leaders, some of them, one of them in particular, invented a slogan that many people today maybe remember having heard, which was a land without a people for a people without a land. You know, it sounds like this wonderful thing. Palestine was supposedly empty, and Jews around the world who didn't have a specific Jewish state, they were living in lots of countries just the way gypsies don't have a gypsy state. But, you know, the idea was that there would be a Jewish state on the land that was just empty. It's sort of absurd that so many people believe that. You know, I expect I would have. In fact, I probably did believe it without thinking about it. This was an ancient land. This is, you know, an area that's called the crossroads of civilization. The thought that it could be empty is just bizarre. But that's what was sold to the general public, both Jewish and non-Jewish. So some Jewish individuals came from Europe and elsewhere, came to Palestine, this supposedly empty land, and realized it was full of people. Some of them wrote in their journals and in letters, you know, we're doing a great wrong here. This is entirely wrong, what we're doing. But, you know, those people were pushed out. Some of them tried to oppose the Zionism. Some of them tried to come up with a milder form, where at least there would be a bicultural state of some sort, where Palestinians would still have some rights there, the Palestinian Christians and Muslims. But overall, those individuals and that thinking was pushed out and continues to be pushed out in the Zionist movement and now in Israel itself.
Isn't it true that in 1897, the World Zionist Organization were actually considering places like Texas, Cyprus, Argentina, and even Uganda as the new Jewish state?
That's right. They were what many people don't realize, because this is often sold to people as, well, this is a religious movement. This is, you know, religious Jews wanting to go back to the Holy Land where there had been a Jewish presence 2,000 years ago. This was not a religious movement. This was a very secular movement. The leaders were largely either agnostic or outright atheists, and they wanted to create a Jewish state somewhere. Herzl, Theodor Herzl, who's considered the father of Israel, really, the father of political Zionism, was very ready to accept Uganda. The British said, well, you could set up your you know, Jewish state in Uganda. Of course, that wasn't asking the people there how they would have thought about that. But that was considered, and if that had happened, it wouldn't be the Palestinian-Israeli conflict or the Arab-Israeli conflict. It would be the Ugandan-Israeli conflict. You know, it's sort of strange to think of that. But Argentina was considered for a while as well. Basically, they settled on Palestine because there was this sort of PR element to it, that it could be pitched to people who looked at it in a religious way because of the biblical connection to Israel by the ancient Israelites, which is very different than the Israeli population today. By the way, at that time, that was the idea, that was the hope and the PR, so they chose Palestine. But religious and observant Jews were especially opposed to Zionism. It did not work at all for many decades, because to the theology that most believed was that they had been dispersed by God, and would be brought back when the Jewish Messiah came. That's when they would go back, not through what they considered a heretical, political, secular movement.
Yeah. Well, I think America would be a totally different place today if Texas was the homeland of the Jews. Don't you agree?
It certainly would be. It would be.
Yeah, I couldn't quite imagine that. I don't know how that would work. Gunslinging Jewish guy with guns hanging off his belt. Yeah, well, I guess that's what they do anyway, don't they?
Well, certainly the settlers have walk around fully armed with rifles slung on their back. If you go into some towns and in Israel, a shopping mall, I'm trying to remember the name of the place I went, that's what you see. Mm-hmm. You see people walking around with guns, with rifles and things right out. You know, it's part of the society in some areas of Israel.
Yeah, but John Wayne as a rabbi, that image just doesn't work for me.
That's hard to imagine. That's true.
You know, in your book, you mention an elitist secret society called the Parushim, which I'd never even heard of before, but I was blown away when I read it, which grew out of the Harvard's University Menorah Society. Can you share with the listening audience today what influence this secret group has had over the shaping of American policy and politics?
Well, this was one of the most extraordinary things that I stumbled across. It's I always like to give people the citations for it, because this sounds like one of those sort of weird conspiracy theories that may or may not be correct. You know, weird theories sometimes have turned out to be correct. But in this case, it's not a weird theory. It's fully corroborated. It's was written about in the American Jewish Historical Quarterly, a well-regarded and respected scholarly journal. It's probably on, you know, in many large campus libraries. I assume they probably have it there. So in that journal, was an article in 1975 published by an Israeli academic, Dr. Sarah Schmidt, who is a professor at a mainstream Israeli university. Her field of study is Zionism, in particular American Zionism. And she wrote this article stating that there had been a secret society called the Parashim, which was a Hebrew word that meant Pharisees and separate, operating in the United States with the agenda to push Zionism throughout the U.S. This was in the early, about 1910s and 1920s. It began, I believe it began around 1912 or so. And one of the leaders of this secret society was Louis Brandeis, who was a Supreme Court justice. This is, you know, startling to read that a Supreme Court justice, while he was a sitting Supreme Court justice, not something he'd maybe done years before when he was a college student and a, you know, fraternity boy or something like that. This is a sitting Supreme Court justice, was a leader in this secret society.
Wow.
Nobody has actually tried to refute that fact. It's basically just been buried. They pushed this, their agenda, throughout the United States. They would recruit a number of important people, businessmen and attorneys and doctors, you know, as well as young graduates from Harvard. Ambitious young graduates were also being recruited into this society.
And I do believe that Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, you've actually been attacked by Max Blumenthal for exposing that. Is that not true?
That's correct. You know, this was startling to me. Max Blumenthal is, of course, the son of Sidney Blumenthal, who's a very well-known White House insider. He's quite close to Clintons, to both Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton. So this is really a very powerful family. Anyway, Max is the son, and he has been, in recent years, very pro-Palestinian. He's done some videos and written some books and gives lectures that are often very valuable. Mm-hmm. He wrote a book called Goliath that tells about the racism endemic in Israeli society. I think he's written another book recently. But again, you know, often what we find is that some of these individuals seem to only want to go so far and want to keep some parts of this story hidden from the general public. It seems to be okay for them to know it, but they don't want everyone else to know it. So the information I have about Brandeis, he has attacked it elsewhere, trying to claim that it's unfounded and it's not evidence-based and it's just this foolish thing that I've made up. Well, as you've mentioned, my book, if there's anything my book is, it is fully cited. Just about every fact in it has a citation and often more than one source for the fact, so that everybody can go and look at the information for themselves. Mm. And this part about Brandeis is also extremely well cited. As I said, it's from this academic journal. It's also from a book that was written by a mainstream author named Peter Gross that was published by an establishment publisher, Knopf. Gross himself was the diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times. He was also at Harvard. So he also wrote about the Parashim and of Brandeis' connection to it. Then, as I mentioned before, Dr. Sarah Schmidt, who was the professor who first really divulged the Parashim to the general public, also writes about it, had a whole book about the founder of the Parashim, and has a whole chapter about the Parashim itself. The founder is also very interesting. He was Horace Kallen, who was a professor at the University of Wisconsin. Before that, he had been at Princeton. He was actually the first Jewish faculty member ever to be hired at Princeton. Then he went to Wisconsin, and while he was at Wisconsin, he started this secret society pushing Zionism. One of the ironies about this is that Kallen himself is considered sort of the founder of cultural pluralism, you know, the idea of having of a multicultural society was what he was doing outwardly in the United States. But Zionism is to create a unicultural country in which it will be a Jewish state, not welcoming to other to non-Jews. So there's quite a double standard here, sort of a hypocritical way of approaching the world, where he was a minority in the United States, he was in favor of multiculturalism. But then when if he could create his own state, there he would not be in favor of multiculturalism. So it's sort of an interesting footnote to Callan himself and also to Brandeis.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I first came across some of Max Blumenthal's work, I think it was about 2005, he infiltrated a GOP conference to interview some of the university graduates about their chicken hawk and their warlike stature and warlike opinions that they had, and none of them would sign up. They were all in it for the politics, and that really brought him to my radar as somebody who stands up for Palestine and stands up for Arabic rights. But now that you have kind of exposed his link to the Clinton criminal cadre, I'm just wondering: are there? Do you think there is a lot of pro-Palestinian people out there that are actually crypto-Sayanim, that are little helpers to the Israeli Zionist cause? Do you think that's possible?
I think it's not only possible, I think it's probable. You know, any movement is infiltrated. Any important movement will be infiltrated. That, you know, history has shown that. It's not to say that most people are you know, Israeli agents, knowingly or sort of unconsciously, but certainly that's going on. I have no doubt that would go on. And, you know, none of us know who those are. We just know historically that social justice movements are infiltrated by the opposition. The idea is to have agent provocateurs that can be in a movement and can influence it to take stands that are harmful to the movement itself, to prevent it.
And divisive.
Success. Divisive, exactly, to divide people up, you know, from one another, to prevent the kind of unity that is more likely to be successful, to cause dissension, to cause action. Strategic actions that are perhaps not well thought out that will hurt the movement. So, in fact, this is written about openly by there's an institute in Israel called the Reut Institute. It's R-E-U-T. That's sort of a strategic think tank that comes up with strategies that Israel should use, both military strategies, but also PR strategies, activist strategies, etc. And it specifically talked about the idea of trying to divide the movement for Palestine and to try to name shame is the word that they used for attacking individuals within the movement as a way to cause dissension, to cause division, to try to marginalize some of the most effective and committed people. And we see that going on.
Yes, yes, indeed. Stay right with us, Miss Allison Weir. We're just going to have a short break. This is the People Who Speak radio show. I'm your host, Steve Johnson, talking to you live and direct with special guest author Allison Weir, live on internet radio and across the world. We'll be right back with our guest and audience questions after this short message break.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
With over 150 million registered users, PalTalk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 PalTalk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining PalTalk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Today's school libraries are filled with endless opportunities. With access to print and digital materials, the latest technologies, and the guidance of a school librarian, our children are empowered with the tools they need to succeed in school and beyond. I'm Julianne Moore. Join me in celebrating all of the ways that school libraries and librarians are transforming learning for our students. For more information on how you can become involved, visit the American Association of School Librarians at aasl.org.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you.
Welcome back. You're listening to the People Speak radio show on BBS Radio Network, coming to you live across America and across the world in real time. I'm your host, Steve Johnson, and we're back with our guest tonight. Miss Allison Weir is the author of ifamericansknew.org, and she's done a lot of great work for supporting Palestinian rights. She has just written an amazing book that is available on Amazon.com called Against Our Better Judgment: The Hidden History of How the U.S. Was Used to Create Israel. And I recommend everybody to get that book. Even if you know a lot about the subject, you're going to find out a whole lot more. Welcome back there, Allison Weir, ma'am.
Hi, I'm glad to be back.
It's great to have you. We have a question from our audience, our listening audience. This is Comrade Batanga living in Oklahoma. He has a question. Do you believe that lobbying is just legalized corruption?
That's a good point. Not necessarily. You know, lobbying is to try to promote your interest. So it's done by teachers, by doctors, by nurses, by farmers. You know, trying to sort of say, here are our needs. Maybe farmers somewhere are having trouble and they want their crops subsidized, or they want some sort of trade barrier against other crops that are taking jobs away from them. You know, in general, it's a group of people who are trying to promote something that they feel is important to them. Mm-hmm. The problem is, of course, that it's important to some subset of the American population. It might be beneficial to a subset, but it might be damaging to the general population. So in the end, you know, the decision should be made about, well, what's best for most people? What fits the principles? What's best for the general public? What do we want in those terms? The problem with lobbying, too, of course, is that often it's just whoever has the most money. So then it's corrupt in that sense that money can buy policies. And I think all of us are opposed to that. So in that sense, you know, I can see that it's the point of the caller. I think it's money is the biggest problem of all.
So your short answer is not necessarily, but yes, it can be.
And that's right.
Okay. We have a question from Winston Smith in Hawaii. Miss Weir, have you had any interaction with Palestinian rights activist and former U.S. Marine Ken O'Keefe?
I've never met Ken O'Keefe. I've read about what he's been doing, a lot of his activities. I know he was certainly very involved in the flotilla movement, and I think was beaten up when the ship he was on, or the boat he was on, was attacked by the Israeli military. Mm-hmm. I know there've been some controversies about him, but I certainly respect what he has done and feel he's a very committed activist on this issue.
Yeah, a lot of respect for Ken.
Yes, absolutely. One thing about the previous question that maybe I should just emphasize is that lobbying is one thing, but when you're lobbying on behalf of a foreign country, which is what AIPAC is doing, for example, that in that case, you're supposed to register as a foreign lobby. That's what is required. It's legal, but you register as a foreign lobby. AIPAC, the Israel lobby, has eluded that requirement. So, in effect, many of us feel it's acting illegally by not having registered and by not being required to adhere to the regulations that it should be having to follow.
Oh, could you extend that to the ADL as well?
I think the ADL is certainly lobby, you know, the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League. Many people, and I used to think this myself, think, well, what a good group. This is to prevent defamation of Jewish Americans and bigotry and to oppose sort of bullying against the minority. But unfortunately, when you work on Israel-Palestine, it quickly becomes clear that the ADL is main purpose, it seems to me, is certainly one of its main purposes and activities, is to defame people who are trying to provide the facts about Israel-Palestine.
And absolutely.
Push policies that will benefit Israel, that, or at least that in its mind will benefit Israel, rather than policies that would benefit all people.
Yes, absolutely, that they're in it for themselves and their own little agenda. We have a question here from Rajiv in Western Australia. Why was the Ottoman Empire never actually conquered or threatened after World War I? Was this to ensure the establishment and the free reign of Israel?
Well, the Ottoman Empire was actually defeated in World War I. It was allied with Germany. So in World War I, it was Britain and the United States and some others against Germany and the Ottoman Empire and some others. And Germany and the Ottoman Empire actually lost the war. So after the war, there's the Versailles Treaty, the Paris peace talks, and the Ottoman Empire was dismembered and largely divided between France and Britain. Palestine was part of the Ottoman Empire, and then after World War I, it came under the control of Britain.
Right, right. We have a question here from Nephilim in Geraldton, Australia. When Edwin Black, the author of the transfer agreement, stated in his book, and I quote, "The great irony is that Adolf Hitler became the chief economic sponsor of Israel," unquote, it outraged many, many Jews. Do you think this outraged them because he was a little too close to the truth with that statement?
I think so, yes.
Mm. You do mention the book, The Transfer Agreement, in your book. You do mention that. Can you let the audience know a little bit more? What exactly was the transfer agreement?
Well, this was an agreement basically between Zionist leaders and the Nazis, where the some money would be transferred from Zionists to the Zionists.
Nazi Germany.
That's right. And Nazi Germany would allow some Jews to move to Palestine. Basically, Zionist leaders went to the Nazis and said, well, we both want the same thing. You want Jews out of Germany. We want them in Palestine, so let's work together and make that happen. It was basically what was at the root of all of that. This has been exposed in a number of books. I have a little bit about it in my book, and then I refer people to other books on it, such as by Black and by Lenny Brenners and other authors written about that quite a bit. This was a great scandal, of course, when it came out after the war and when it came out in Israel. So it's widely known, I believe, in Israel. Certainly it was. It was considered very scandalous and a major controversy. But it's, again, been sort of swept under the rug, and most people don't know about it.
Yes, today it's a hidden history. When I first learned about that from a CBS, I think it was a news article from the 1980s, I was like, my God, why don't people even know this?
That's right. I think that's one of the things that starts opening your eyes. Because, you know, it sounds like you've gone through the same type of experience I have. Where I'm learning these facts, I'm thinking, this is, this is bizarre. Why don't I know this? Why haven't I heard this before? You know, these are significant facts, and yet we don't know them. And that sort of opens your eyes to the massive cover-up that's been going on for so long. And that now continues with not just, you know, with everybody from the ADL to Max Blumenthal taking part in trying to cover up some of these facts and preventing them from getting to the general public.
Right, right. We have a question from Eddie Sugiarto in Malaysia. He wants to know, is it really true that in 1917, the Zionists actually sabotaged a peace plan with the Turkish in preference to wanting Palestine by other methods than negotiation.
Yes, it's basically true. There was, it's a little more, you know, like most things, it's a little bit more complicated. Basically, it looked like the Ottoman Empire was tiring of the war and was probably, or at least it looked like it might be ready to make a separate peace, even if Germany wasn't ready to concede, to, you know, surrender. The Ottoman Empire had sent out these peace feelers, it appeared, that they might end their participation in the war. You know, this would have saved massive lives if that had gone forward. So the U.S. State Department decided to pursue it. They were going to send a representative over to negotiate that. Louis Brandeis and Felix Frankfurter, who was an associate, Frankfurter also became a Supreme Court justice. The two of them decided, oh, you know, we can't let this happen, because if that happened, then the Ottoman Empire would have remained. And they wanted it defeated by the British, because they had a deal with the British that once the British won the war, they would basically be able to start their Zionist colonization. So
yeah, right.
They want the Ottoman Empire to surrender. They wanted it to be defeated. So they managed to take some actions that prevented the negotiations from going forward.
We have another question from Winston Smith in Hawaii. Miss Weir, did you find any Israeli connection to the events on 9/11?
Well, that's not part of my book, so I don't have anything about that. My book really just ends with the creation of Israel. But certainly there are connections. There are Israeli connections to 9/11, you know, for what they're worth. We certainly need a better new investigation of 9/11. But I think one of the most significant things that's, again, been swept under the rug is that there were those five Israelis that were filming the trade towers when they were burning and collapsing.
Absolutely.
They were rounded up by American law enforcement. After a few months, they were allowed to go back, and little has been said about them ever since.
We have a question here from Peter in Melbourne, Australia. What are your thoughts on the Naturai Carter, the anti-Zionist group? Do you think they are Sayanim as well, just out to try and help Israel, or are they really actually against the state of Israel?
I think they're authentic. I have met them a number of times, and I do feel that I don't think that they're agents for Israel. I think this is their authentic religious belief.
And that they actually do stand up for Palestinian rights?
They do. Yes, they do.
Right. You didn't mention in your book, but what are your thoughts on the Project for the New American Century? Because I know a lot of major Zionists were in the PNAC plan, were in the PNAC group. Do you think that they were involved at all, or have some underhand to undermine the U.S. Political situation?
I think that's a group that deserves much more attention. I think members of that group and it's not just I think this, there are at least two books that have well documented that some of those members, the neoconservatives who are passionately attached to Israel, are the decisive reason that the U.S. invaded Iraq. That's been documented by Stephen Snagosky in his book, The Transparent Cabal, and also in another excellent book that was published by, I think it was Edinburgh University Press. So, and others have written articles about it. But those individuals have continually pushed policies of U.S. aggression in the Middle East on behalf of Israel that were damaging really to the whole Middle East and to the United States.
You know, I do consider myself quite well-read on topics of hidden historical truths. For example, like the sinking of the Lusitania to get the USA involved in World War I. But while I was reading your book, I began to learn that there was so much more to the story and that there was so much more that I hadn't learned. For example, about the Zimmerman note. How was it for you learning so much about this actual history that is never talked about? Did you feel like you were sinking down the rabbit hole once you started researching this?
Well, it was really fascinating, truthfully, you know, to discover these things. And especially now there are more and more resources that where you know people have been studying these further and more has come out than used to be known, both about the Zimmermann letter and about the Lusitania. So the Lusitania wasn't a major part of my book. I just mentioned it because it was one of the factors that people believe led to the U.S. entry into World War I. But when you look into it further, I'm not so sure that was a major factor. I think it's the Zionist factor may have been a more important one. You know, it seems certainly possible that it was. And again, none of us know that. You know, as an American, I feel I should know my own history, and there are some aspects of this history that have been sort of kept out of American history books.
Yeah, quite deliberately, too.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm a generation that has seen our history books improve quite a bit. They used to just give the, you know, sort of American narrative and mythology of a perfectly beneficial nation, whereas every nation, of course, has its faults and flaws. And many of those have now been addressed in newer history books where we, you know, talk more about what was done with Native Americans and Japanese internment camps, etc. So things that were covered up before, fortunately, are now, I feel, being covered in American history books. But some elements, such as this, that have to do with Zionism, are still very much absent.
You know, when Benjamin Netanyahu visited the United States in 1988, he visited there with the name Ben Nitte. And interestingly, his name changed later on. Do you find that's a common thread with Zionists who live in the United States? They actually change their names and nobody knows their background. Do you see that often?
I do know that about him. I'm not sure if I've really come across that as a general thing or not. But I do wonder how many of these, you know, I'm concerned about the dual citizenship, where a lot of people may or may not have citizenship with Israel. Some of our governmental leaders, for example, and high officials may be Israeli citizens. And I think that if that's the case, we should know it. I think voters and citizens should have the right to know that, to be aware that somebody has a loyalty to a different nation. Because at some point, nations' interests will diverge. Certainly, Israeli interests are very different from American interests. So if somebody like Paul Wolfowitz, for example, who has been a high governmental official, is an Israeli citizen, as I think he could be, we should be aware of that. And at this point, there's really no mechanism by which an American can learn that kind of information about our own governmental representatives.
Yeah, and especially we should know that if he's in charge of any aspect of the American military sending out American soldiers to die.
That's right. That's right. Mm. I think. And yet again, this is the cover-up. That's what's extraordinary about this cover-up is that cover-ups are usually, you know, the right wing wants to cover up certain things and the left wing wants to cover up other things, truthfully. This cover-up really pervades both across the political spectrum in many cases. So, for example, the question of dual loyalties has been raised by a writer, and yet a well-known progressive website would not publish his article because it involved Israel, and that was taboo.
And you think a lot of websites and a lot of news media sources won't actually tell the truth because they might get attacked as being anti-Semitic. There's that fear.
I think that's right. I think either they're afraid they'll be called anti-Semitic or they themselves are Israel partisans. So sort of between those two factors, it prevents a lot of information from being published on the more mainstream or the larger websites. Fortunately, there are these other ones. Counterpunch is excellent. There's another group, antiwar.com, has been quite good. So there, the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, The Link. Most of those things I've just named are probably unknown to most people, but those are the places where you can get this information.
Fantastic. You know, the thing that blows me away is when they call somebody anti-Semitic who is supporting Palestine, I find that quite ironic. I find it almost hypocritical because Palestinians are the true Semitic people of the region. Do you not agree?
They are. That's right. And certainly many Israelis may have no ancestry in the region really at all. There's certainly a number of books and articles that seem to indicate that they may have been from a group that had converted to Judaism far later than that and have no roots in the Middle East or any real Semitic background to them.
Yeah, most of the Israelis living in Israel today, they're either Khazars or they're Russian blow-ins or immigrants or their parents were forced there. As exposed in your book, a lot of them went to Israel not by choice but by force. Is that not true?
That's largely true. I mean, no, certainly, you know, some went voluntarily, but there was a great deal of pressure and manipulation to get people to move there. Most didn't want to do that. You know, most of the Jewish Americans said, I'm an American. You know, I have no interest in Zionism or going there. Throughout the Middle East, there were Jewish populations throughout North Africa and the Middle East. They, too, had no interest originally in going to Israel. I cover some of that in my book.
Considering the death and destruction and how much bloodshed is spilled by Israel themselves, do you consider Israel as any kind of religious or holy land anymore?
Well, certainly the government I don't consider holy or sacred or, you know, it's...
In any way religious?
No. Well, you know, it depends on how you define religion. Certainly, you know, most of us, I would define it in a positive way, but of course there are ways that some people interpret religion that's very violent and not very positive. So there are religious elements to Israel that are... Again, that part's not well known because there are extremist forms of Judaism that exist everywhere. Just, you know, every religion has extremist versions of it.
True.
And the extremist versions there are fairly influential at high levels of government because they can sort of be the swing vote. So even though they're a minority of Israelis, fortunately, they have disproportionate power in Israeli policies. And that's very troubling to many Israelis as well as to many others.
Mm. Do you see this infiltration, not only in the United States, but infiltration in all the Five Eyes countries of Australia, of Canada, of the UK, of America? Do you see this infiltration as part of a bigger agenda for a greater Israel, their plan for world domination? I know it sounds like a James Bond a spy plot, and it probably is. That's why it's so unbelievable to a lot of people. They're like, that can't be possible. But do you see that as that's their plan, to infiltrate governments and get their agenda in?
Well, I am very reluctant to go to large conspiracies, you know, without sufficient evidence. I don't see them. I don't, at this point, haven't arrived at the conclusion that they're trying to dominate the world. But they do need to, they do... really quite openly in some of their analytical writings, talk about the need to dominate the Middle East, you know, to dominate the whole Middle East, and that's probably extending over into North Africa as well. You know, when you have committed a massive ethnic cleansing in a region, you have to dominate it because the rest of the region is not happy with that. You know, the rest of the region is destabilized and has all these refugees that have fled from Israel in 1947 to 49 during the original war of ethnic cleansing. Then 1967, there's another war causing more refugees to flee. So Israel realized that to continue its existence as a Jewish state in which non-Jews would be pushed out, they needed military dominance of the region. They needed to acquire weaponry and money, mainly from the United States, originally more from Britain and Eastern Europe, but now mostly from the United States, and that they also needed to prevent the other nations in the whole area from becoming successful, from becoming prosperous, because if they were prosperous, successful nations, there was the chance that they might challenge Israel and they might actually support Palestinian human rights. You know, they couldn't let that happen. So they have played a role in preventing that kind of development in the region. They've invaded Lebanon at least twice, major invasions. They've invaded Egypt and Syria. They bought off Jordan. They've attacked, you know, a number of countries in the region. They've certainly now are pushing the U.S. to attack Iran. We've placed Iran under an economic embargo that was really almost tantamount to an act of war on behalf of Israel pushed by these neoconservatives. So in terms of domination of the world, I don't see that, at least not literally or directly, although domination of the region, and certainly when you think about it, there is a domination of the United States in order to carry out that regional supremacy.
For sure, but I have seen myself personally here in Australia, groups like the B'nai B'rith and groups like the Chabad Lubavitch have actually influenced court trials for individuals. They have actually influenced political policies. They've actually influenced education policies. They've had their hand in just about everything. Even the Port Arthur gun massacre in 1996 in Tasmania, they were actually instrumental in covering up some of the facts about what happened there. So I've seen personally, living in Australia, that the hidden hand of these groups that actually do dot the planet. They do go out into other countries and they get together and get their communities. That's not a theory. That's not a conspiracy. It's actually happening. And I can see in your book that it happened a long time ago in America, and I feel sad. Have you ever thought about leaving America, ma'am?
Now and then when you feel really discouraged, I've sort of thought of that, but, you know, I this is my home, and I plan to stay here, and I plan to, you know, I think it sort of would be a cop-out to just leave. I think Americans in general, when enough of us learn about this, we'll oppose what's going on and can bring change, and I think it's our responsibility to do that, and it would be wrong for me to leave and sort of abrogate that responsibility.
Well, you're definitely a fighter, and you're definitely a hero for not only Palestinian cause, but you're a patriot for your country, and I salute you, ma'am. I stand proud knowing that you've served your country, and you still are.
Thank you. Thanks.
Wow, that's amazing. Have you got any plans to go to other countries and talk, to actually spread this message out a bit further, and not just do conferences and speech engagements in America, but go other places overseas?
I'd like to do more of that. I've done some. I did a speaking tour in a small one in England and also spoke in Wales. I've spoken in Palestine several times at some campuses there and in Iraq and Qatar. And I was in Iran a few months ago giving some lectures at universities there. I'd love to come to Australia and speak there and also learn about what's going on in these places. You know, certainly there's a strong Israel lobby in Britain. In Canada, as you've described, and I know only a little, but there's certainly an Israel lobby in Australia. So I think it's
I'm sure you'd be very, very welcome here, that's for sure. Well, you've been listening to the People Speak radio show with special guest author Alison Weir, and I'd like to thank her and remind all the listeners to look out for her book called Against Our Better Judgment, The Hidden History of How the USA Was Used to Create Israel. Thanks so much for being on the show today, Alison, ma'am.
Thank you for having me.
One final question. Do you support the stop funding of Israel?
Yes. Yes. Time to stop funding Israel.
Oh, I love you. Thank you very much for that. Thanks again for being on the show.
Thank you.
Join us again coming up soon on the People Speak radio show when I talk with journalist Geroid Al-Komain from Ireland and Australian spiritualist Elish D'Avalon. Stay tuned for those big interviews coming up soon. A great amount of thanks go out to the producers, Mike, Doug, and Donald, and to all my friends throughout the world and all the guys who have given me so much support. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. It's been a fantastic interview today. I've loved having Alison Weir on. I've been waiting for this interview for about 6 years, to be honest. You can tune into my own channel on YouTube called Stop Funding Israel. But for me for now, take care, and bye until next time. Hope you enjoyed this one just as much as I did.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is